Watch America's Book Club, Sunday, December 14th, with our guest best-selling author, Arthur Brooks. He joins our host, David Rubenstein. Watch America's Book Club, Sundays at 6 p.m. Eastern and Pacific on C-SPAN.
U.S. warships off the coast. More than 20 attacks on vessels, over 80 dead. The airspace is closed. Is Venezuela facing an invasion? Or is this political theater with deadly consequences?
Ich denke, Venezuela braucht eine Demokratisierung.
I think Venezuela needs a democratization process that draws its main momentum from within the country itself. But I am not very hopeful that an external intervention, and even less so a military one, will bring a peaceful and sustainable democracy to Venezuela.
Eine friedliche und nachhaltige Demokratie nach Venezuela bringen wird.
In Crisis Mode, the podcast from Conflict Zones with Jan Jessen.
Welcome to In Crisis Mode. I'm Jan Jessen, head of politics at NRZ and crisis reporter for the Funke Mediengruppe. Since September, U.S. units have repeatedly attacked boats off Venezuela's coast. By now, dozens of people have been killed. The official justification, the fight against drug trafficking. In the Caribbean, the USS Gerald R. Ford is positioned, the largest aircraft carrier in the United States. From the U.S. perspective, the airspace is considered closed. Caracas has responded with mobilization and military exercises. What does all this mean for the people on the ground, and what's really driving this politically? Trump has spoken by phone with Venezuelan President Maduro, but details remain undisclosed. There are rumors and media reports suggesting he urged the Venezuelan leader, an autocratic ruler, to step down. A U.S. senator has even spoken of an offer to leave the country. At the same time, the United States considers Venezuelan airspace closed, while Caracas has asked OPEC for political backing. Before we dive into this political game, or political showdown, I think it's worth first looking at daily life for people in Venezuela. And Jörg Butterfuhr is our first guest. He's a diplomatic geographer from Essen and has known Venezuela since 1988. From 2018 to 2024, he lived in the capital, Caracas. He describes how the city and its sense of security has changed.
Das erste Mal war ich 1988 im nördlichen Südamerika.
The first time I was in Northern South America was in 1988, including Venezuela. I really liked the country, and several decades later, when the question arose of where my wife could go abroad as a teacher, and Caracas was an option, I actually managed to convince my wife to give it a try. So from 2018 to 2024, we went to Caracas. My wife worked at the German school there. I was immediately brought on board as well. And in 2024, we returned because a contract here still called, which had to be fulfilled.
Yes, that's an interesting observation. When people talk about Venezuela, and especially when you read about it, you often come across stories about chaos, rising insecurity, problems, and so on. But Jörg says the opposite is happening. Security is improving, everyday crime is declining, and the roles within the city's social fabric are shifting. So he's offering a perspective that's somewhat different from what we typically hear in our media.
Also, als wir 2018 gekommen sind, war die Situation eine ganz andere noch als 2024, wo wir gegangen sind. 2017 soll ein Jahr gewesen sein, wo es eine heftige Krise gab, auch wirtschaftlich.
So when we arrived in 2018, the situation was still very different from 2024, when we left. 2017 had been a year of severe crisis, also economically, with shortages in supermarkets and so on. By the end of 2018, when we arrived, that was no longer the case. You could buy everything normally. Of course, like in many Latin American countries, there were extreme differences between rich and poor. We were in a bubble of the wealthy or middle class, which was also required because we worked at the German school. Over the years, however, the security situation improved dramatically. As we already noticed this in 2019. And before the pandemic broke out, it was possible to move around large parts of the city alone at night without problems. The pandemic then contributed to many people who had previously been involved in crime and saw no opportunities in the country leaving. Many went to Ecuador, many to Peru or Chile. And another part, this is a little joke we always make, the motorized criminals who used to drive around streets and steal people's phones now simply deliver food. Restaurants had been closed for a long time. People still wanted food from restaurants, and so a large part of these people is now employed by various delivery services.
Die Leute wollten trotzdem Essen aus dem Restaurant bekommen und so ist ein großer Teil dieser Leute halt mittlerweile in Lohn und Brot bei irgendwelchen Lieferdiensten.
Mr. Butefur also says there's something like a we're taking back the city movement that's bringing public spaces back to life. For me, the Botanical Garden is the symbolic example of that.
Kurz vor Ausbruch der Pandemie gab es so eine Bewegung, die nannte sich Wir holen uns unsere Stadt zurück.
Shortly before the outbreak of the pandemic, there was a movement called We're Taking Back Our City. This was a story that cut across almost all social layers, where people would consciously go out at night in groups, visit a few restaurants, bars and pubs, and simply use the protection of the group. This was also taken up by many cultural initiatives, which then offered more city tours and guided walks. You always have to keep in mind that there had been a severe economic crisis, especially the years 2015, 16 and 17 were extreme. Many places, museums, the botanical garden and so on were closed. There were areas where it was really like the Wild West, places you definitely wouldn't go to at that time, and gradually these areas were revived. For example, at the beginning of 2021, we attended the first guided tour of the botanical garden. After it had been closed for 3 years, the botanical garden had been a haven for criminals and drug addicts, and the police station that was supposed to be there had been closed for several years. The facilities were partially devastated, but they were painstakingly restored. Today, the Botanical Garden is a showpiece where people can visit normally and regular tours are offered. This is simply the kind of transformation that has taken place.
Und regelmäßig auch Führungen angeboten werden. Das ist einfach dieser Wandel, der da stattgefunden hat.
Butefur also says that the perception of risks is politically charged, politically contested. That even applies to the way people deal with travel advisories.
Der deutsche Botschafter Volker Pellet.
The German ambassador, Volker Pellet, as he is currently called, travels a lot in Caracas, but also throughout the country. He is an avid motorcyclist and regularly posts about it. Last week, he climbed the main hill of Caracas with a German organist who was visiting, accompanied by his wife, I believe, and one other person. And yes, it was all very relaxed. The current interior minister, Diosdado Cabello, used this post by the German ambassador as an opportunity to repost it and raise the question of how credible the recommendations issued by the German Foreign Office really are if the German ambassador himself wanders alone through nature.
Botschafter selber da alleine durch die Natur wandert.
These are, I think, quite interesting observations to begin with. And what I found most interesting actually came out of the conversation with her about the economic situation in the country. I had always assumed that the economic situation was extremely difficult and that those in power in Venezuela, specifically the leftist nationalist president Nicolas Maduro, had basically driven the country into the ground. I had read a lot about hyperinflation. I had read a lot about mass impoverishment. But you say that this isn't fundamentally the case. On the contrary, some things have improved, and I found that really fascinating.
Also insgesamt gab's in den letzten 5 Jahren eine deutliche.
Overall, over the past 5 years, there has been a significant improvement in the economic situation, but it is still the case that poorer people have an income that barely covers their living expenses. People have their apartment or their own house, and they can buy their food, but beyond that, there is not much room for anything else. We're talking about a monthly income in the range of $200 to $400. This will be the case for a very large part of the population. Living in the countryside or a small town makes it easier to manage than in Caracas. Caracas has a price level similar to Spain. And then, of course, there is a middle class, which is not as large as in European countries, with incomes around $800 to $1,000 and a very small, very wealthy upper class.
Sehr reiche Oberschicht.
This is the perspective of someone who has lived in Caracas, the capital of Venezuela for several years, Jörg Butterfuhr. I've known Jörg for quite a while, back from my time as a local reporter in Essen. We're on familiar terms, and I know he leans left politically, and perhaps, without meaning to be disrespectful, he may also be wearing rose-colored glasses. That's why we also spoke with an analyst and asked ourselves, why is there this U.S. pressure right now? What is myth and what is fact? How stable is this system, the system that emerged from the Bolivarian Revolution, Chavismo, even though it's a politically charged question? For that, we spoke with Claudia Ziller. She's a senior fellow in the Americas Research Group at the Stiftung Wissenschaft und Politik in Berlin. She's been observing Venezuela for many, many years from a scientific perspective. Of course, I also asked specifically, what's actually true about the story that Venezuela is the main drug-producing and exporting country? That's the current accusation, and you may have seen it in the news, which is why the U.S. is bombing boats off the Venezuelan coast. The U.S. says, in essence, this is a fight against drugs, against what they call drug terror. I find that a very interesting term. It's not just drug trafficking. The U.S. now frames it as drug terror that floods and threatens their country, and that's the U.S. narrative, hence these attacks on the boats. And that's what I asked right away. Is that actually correct? Is Venezuela really the country currently flooding the U.S. with drugs?
Diese Informationen sind alle widersprüchlich und passen auch mit verschiedenen politischen Maßnahmen der Regierung Trump nicht zusammen.
All this information is contradictory and also does not align with various political measures of the Trump administration, if I may unpack it. Looking at cocaine production, the main countries are Colombia, Bolivia, and Peru. That means Venezuela is not among the cocaine producers. Fentanyl is synthetic, its production works differently, and for that, you don't need a plant. But fentanyl trafficking happens mainly at the border between Mexico and the US, and cocaine reaches the US primarily via the Pacific route, not the Atlantic. So, looking at drug production and trafficking routes, Venezuela is not at the center. Venezuela is more of a transit country for drugs and more for those going to Europe. But even there, it is not at the forefront.
Über den Atlantik. Also, das heißt, wenn man sich die Drogenproduktion und die Handelswege anguckt, steht Venezuela nicht im Mittelpunkt. Venezuela ist für Drogen eher ein Transitland und mehr für Drogen, die nach Europa kommen, aber auch nicht an vorderster Stelle.
So the fight against drugs and against what they call drug terror. From Dr. Ziller's perspective, that seems at least partly a pretext. Venezuela is not the main drug-producing or exporting country in Latin America. She points to countries like Colombia and Mexico, other countries, but not Venezuela. So this appears, at least in part, to be a pretext to put pressure on Venezuela or to attack it. She also spoke about this so-called cartel. You may have heard of it. It's an alleged drug cartel in Venezuela that is now considered a terrorist organization by the US. But in reality, it isn't really a cartel. It's basically a loose network of military and civilian actors enriching themselves across both illegal and legal markets. So it's not a classic drug cartel like you might know from Mexico or other countries. Another reason often cited for this U.S. aggression toward Venezuela is the contested 2024 election. In July 2024, elections were held in Venezuela. Maduro declared himself the winner. Observers from the U.S., the European Union, and other Latin American countries expressed serious doubts about whether the election was conducted fairly, raising concerns about possible fraud. There were nationwide protests, reports of arrests, and incidents of violence. And the core dispute remains. The election records have not been released, and there are serious doubts whether Maduro, who has now been president of Venezuela for 12 years, actually won the July 2024 elections.
Zu diesen Präsidentschaftswahlen gab es davor Vorwahlen innerhalb der Opposition. Und Siegerin dieser Vorwahlen unter sehr schweren Bedingungen war Maria Corina Machado. So wurde sie Kandidatin der Opposition, aber die venezolanische Wahlbehörde...
Prior to these presidential elections, there were primary elections within the opposition, and the winner under very difficult conditions was Maria Corina Machado. She thus became the opposition's candidate, but the Venezuelan Electoral Authority, in a country that is an autocracy, revoked her permission to actively participate in the elections. As a result, the opposition, which had democratically chosen its own candidate, had to repeatedly nominate a replacement. I say repeatedly because Edmundo González, who was eventually officially recognized as the candidate, was not the opposition's second choice. There was another name in between, which was also not accepted by the electoral authority. This already shows that the conditions under which the elections were held were not competitive. The big question was always whether there would also be fraud in the counting of votes. Since voting and counting in Venezuela is electronic, it was claimed that fraud would not be possible. However, it is assumed that fraud did occur. The opposition and various citizens acting in a monitoring role during the elections could credibly show that the opposition won with over 60% of the vote and that Maduro lost. The government claims the opposite, that the incumbents clearly won, but they are unable to present the records to prove this result. All evidence points to not only autocratic manipulation of the election conditions to make victory difficult, but also to an actual opposition win that was not recognized, without the government being able to prove the opposite with records or facts.
Und dann mit den Akten dieses Ergebnis zu belegen. Alles spricht dafür, dass hier nicht nur autokratisch mit den Bedingungen der Wahlen umgegangen ist, um der Position einen Wahlsieg zu erschweren, sondern dass es tatsächlich einen Wahlsieg gab, den dann nicht anerkannt wurde, ohne das Gegenteil mit Akten, mit Fakten beweisen zu können.
So obviously, at least according to Dr. Ziller, but also many other observers, these elections were not conducted properly. And yes, it has become a very autocratic regime, you have to say. Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, has turned the country into an autocracy. This had already started under his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, who, unlike Maduro, was very charismatic. Now the country seems to be sliding further into autocracy, possibly a dictatorship, where the intelligence services have their hands on everything happening in the country. The military is extremely powerful, and other security forces, like the police, are tightly controlled. Since 2015, there have already been attempts at sanctions. Back then, there was also criticism of the elections or allegations of fraud, and attempts were made to bring about regime change through sanctions, as we know. So for 10 years, these sanctions have been in place, but they don't seem to really challenge the system. This may also be because Russia and China support the country. Not only that, but as a major oil exporter, Venezuela also earns foreign currency through sales to the US and other buyers. Moreover, the government and the security apparatus are very closely intertwined. They benefit from the regime, and naturally, they have a strong interest in preserving it.
Sanktionen sind nicht dafür bekannt, zum Erfolg zu bringen bei dieser Art von Zielen. Also das ist an sich ein Problem von Sanktionen. Sie können den Druck erhöhen, aber nicht zu einer bestimmten deutlichen Handlung zwingen.
Sanctions are not known to succeed in achieving these kinds of goals. That is inherently a problem with sanctions. They can increase pressure, but they cannot force a clear, decisive action. The strength of the regime lies in the very close cooperation between civilians in the government and the military, and in a system of rewards and punishments that creates incentives for these government members to remain loyal. There have repeatedly been purges within the ranks. People have been convicted, arrested. There is also torture in Venezuela, not only against opposition members, but also against those who have failed to demonstrate loyalty. The positive incentives consist in allowing individuals to participate in corruption and enrich themselves. This combination of incentives, both positive and negative, has ensured that everyone has something to lose if they switch sides. What has also been shown so far is that whenever external pressure has increased, cohesion within Venezuela has also strengthened. When outside pressure rises, internal solidarity grows. I cannot recall any fractures that were externally induced.
Wann immer der Druck von außen erhöht wurde, der Zusammenhalt innerhalb Venezuelas wurde auch stärker. Also ich kann mich an keine Brüche erinnern, die extern induziert worden wären.
Jörg Büterfür describes full supermarkets, albeit with tight budgets, but he says that basically the economy is on the rise again. Dr. Ziller puts this in context and says, well, there may have been a bit of stabilization, especially over the last 1 or 2 years. Hyperinflation is also gone. It was, at times, completely insane in Venezuela, with inflation over 10,000% or more. But despite that, poverty and weak basic services remain the reality.
Oft ist es eine Frage des Vergleichs und des Parameters. Also es gab 2024 eine Verbesserung im Vergleich zu einem Jahr davor. Also das heißt, dass im letzten Jahr dadurch, dass die Inflation zurückgegangen ist.
Often it is a question of comparison and parameters. So in 2024, there was an improvement compared to the year before. That means that last year, due to lower inflation and higher oil production, people experienced an improvement. This improvement also stemmed from a certain stabilization. Stability, being able to plan at all, is very important. Of course, this stability becomes fragile in situations like the current one. But surveys or social analyses, such as the Kobe University survey, provide numbers for the last year showing that nearly 60% of households live below the poverty line, or more precisely, in multidimensional poverty. That means poverty that is not only due to low income, but also includes lack of access to healthcare, education, housing, and so on. So more than half of the population, or households to be exact, live in poverty. Yet even a small improvement becomes very important and noticeable for people in everyday life. But the situation is critical. Hospitals cannot provide adequate basic services, not even basic, let alone high-quality care. The statistics and surveys point to an already critical situation.
Keine guten, also wir sprechen nicht von hochqualitativen, sondern grundlegende Dienstleistungen nicht anbieten. Also die Statistiken und die Umfragen weisen auf eine schon kritische Lage auf.
The current conflict also affects the region beyond Venezuela, which in recent years has struggled to organize itself and develop common positions. There's nothing like a European Union in Latin America. The different countries tend to work against each other rather than together. This has intensified over the past few years. Geopolitically, the importance of Latin America has also declined, and Dr. Ziller points this out as well.
Weil es bleibt schon eine Frage, wenn die USA intervenieren sollten, wie werden die anderen Regierungen der Region reagieren? Bedauerlicherweise.
Because it remains a question. If the US were to intervene, how would the other governments in the region react? Unfortunately, Latin America is currently not very well coordinated. Regional organizations are in a crisis, in the sense that they used to achieve more and could initiate better initiatives, finding agreement across ideological boundaries. And that is no longer the case. So political coordination within the region is currently very low. And very often political or ideological sympathies decide positions rather than reference to international law or democracy.
Politische Sympathien, ideologische Sympathien über Haltungen, anstatt dass man sich auf das internationale Recht oder auf die Demokratie bezieht.
Yes, and I think it's really important to say this. According to virtually all observers, the US, by attacking these so-called drug boats, these alleged drug boats, is committing violations of international law. You simply can't carry out extrajudicial killings against people you don't even know, whose names you don't have. Instead, you just say, okay, it's a boat out there, allegedly carrying drug traffickers on board. We don't even know the names of these people. They haven't been legally convicted or anything. So they are declared terrorists, and what they're doing is labeled a terrorist attack against the US. From an international law perspective, that's already a very, very risky claim. And basically, all outside observers say that, What's happening right now is illegal under international law. And of course, that would also be the case if the US were to step up its attacks. Donald Trump has talked about possibly attacking on land. The forces the US has assembled include not just the aircraft carrier USS Gerald R. Ford, but also destroyers and landing ships for potential amphibious operations. That at least hints that the threat is on the table. An attack over land would definitely constitute a war of aggression against a sovereign state and would be incompatible with international law. The ironic, though not really funny, thing is that despite all these threats against Venezuela, despite criticism of the regime, despite the obvious efforts to bring about regime change, and despite the claim that the Venezuelan leadership is responsible for drug trafficking to the US, the US is still a major buyer of Venezuelan oil. Despite all the sanctions, the US remains the main purchaser of Venezuelan crude. And on the other side, it's also important to note that the US supplies a large number of small arms, especially to countries bordering Venezuela. In the end, that can also exacerbate problems that already exist in these countries. Dr. Ziller points this out as well.
Auch da ist es nicht. Venezuela braucht jemanden, der das Öl abnimmt. Venezuela braucht selbst nicht so viel Öl. Und die einzige Ressource ist Öl. Die Wirtschaft ist darauf konzentriert. Es gibt
It is not autarkic. Venezuela needs someone to buy its oil. Venezuela itself does not consume that much oil. And oil is its only resource. The economy is focused on it. There is no industrialization, no diversification. Therefore, Venezuela is heavily dependent on two things. First, that the oil is extracted, and second, that it is purchased. Trump, albeit with limitations, allowed Chevron to operate. Venezuela's main trading partners are the US, with China in second place. Of course, China is a very important buyer of oil, but so are the US. Because of arms embargoes and sanctions, the weapons or military equipment Venezuela needs come from China and Russia, not from Western countries. But it's also not the case that the armed forces are very well equipped. The military is neither professional nor efficient. There is limited funding and some chaos within the regime, albeit with strong cohesion, as I mentioned before.
Also es gibt das Geld nicht und es gibt ein bisschen das Chaos innerhalb des Regimes, wenn auch wie mit hohem Zusammenhalt, wie ich davon gesprochen habe.
As we just discussed, are the Venezuelan armed forces actually capable of repelling an American attack? I would express similar doubts. The regular forces are said to number 123,000 active personnel. On top of that, there are supposedly 6 million volunteers, a kind of reserve militia. And now you hear that even retirees and other civilians are being armed, albeit rudimentarily. Whether they could withstand a US invasion, especially one supported from the air, is a huge question. And the big question is also, what would actually happen to the regime? Because, as was made very clear in our conversation, the regime is not just Maduro himself. Even if Trump and Maduro did have a phone call, as reported in the media, Trump admitted there was at least some contact, during which he allegedly asked Maduro to resign, the debate remains. Could Maduro and his family go into exile, for example, in Russia, a close ally of Venezuela? Or could a scenario unfold similar to what happened with Noriega in Panama in 1989, when the US launched a landing operation citing the country's role in drug trafficking? Noriega was portrayed as a major drug trafficker, was deposed, kidnapped, and tried in the US. That's a scenario one could imagine here, or another possibility, hinted at by the deployment of US drones in Puerto Rico in recent days, is that Maduro could be targeted for elimination. But none of this would actually dismantle the whole regime, because, as made clear, the regime rests on very broad shoulders. Maduro is essentially just the front man. At the end of the day, many people have a vested interest in keeping the regime in place. I mentioned earlier the so-called Sun Cartel. This isn't a classic drug cartel. It's not a formal organization, but a network of many people who have a strong interest in preserving the regime as it is. So even if the head is removed, the regime itself would likely remain. That's the big question. What would happen next? Dr. Ziller also pointed out something I found very interesting. The population is deeply divided. Of course, there are people who want the regime completely gone. The opposition generally wants the regime removed. But the big question is how that could happen. and there are many people who don't want a regime change imposed from the outside, as for example Maria Corina Machado advocates. There's a certain irony here. Last year she was barred from running in the presidential elections, yet this year she received the Nobel Peace Prize, and now she calls for a military intervention in Venezuela. But the opposition doesn't seem to be united on this. And then the question arises, what actually happens if there is a regime change, if Maduro is overthrown? Would the country descend into chaos? Would there be civil war-like scenarios? We've seen this before in other regions like Iraq or Libya, where the violent removal of dictators actually worsened the situation for the population. I also asked Dr. Zilla what she thinks will happen. What will Maduro do? Can he trust the promises made regarding exile abroad? And yes, she has a very clear opinion about what is currently happening in the region.
Ich denke, das hängt vom Vertrauen ab. Also Feinde können ein großes Vertrauen zueinander haben, aber auch nicht. Und es ist die Frage, wie viel Vertrauen hat...
I think it depends on trust. Enemies can have a lot of trust in each other or not. And the question is, how much trust does Maduro have in Trump's promises? Can he rely on them? I believe that will be decisive if this offer is to play any role at all. At the moment, he tries to appear in public from time to time so that people know he hasn't fled or disappeared. How reliable are Trump's guarantees for Maduro? I would have my doubts in his place. That's why I think a safer path would be to leave the country first and then say, okay, I'm already gone, rather than agreeing to be extracted.
Ein sicherer Weg wäre zunächst mal aus dem Land zu gehen und dann zu sagen, okay, ich bin schon weg, als dass sich darauf einlässt, dass rausgebracht wird.
What happens next? What would the US gain? Because the regime, as Trump himself has noted, has no inherent interest in dissolving itself. That probably won't happen. This means the opposition would have to rise up against the forces of the regime, which have entrenched themselves over the past 25 years. Personally, I find it rather unlikely that a regime would simply step aside, surrendering its power, just because Maduro is removed, who, according to many observers, plays a relatively minor role and is essentially just the front man. So the entire regime would have to be dismantled, and that of course brings the Damocles sword of a larger war or conflict, raising questions about whether the opposition could withstand it. Is the opposition armed? Have the US possibly armed opposition forces? Could this all fall into a security vacuum, leading Venezuela, and perhaps Latin America, into a scenario similar to what we've seen in Libya or Iraq? That would be catastrophic, as those countries suffered years of civil war and ongoing instability. And Venezuela certainly does not want that, as Dr. Zilla pointed out. At the very beginning, the best-case scenario would be a democratic process, a movement toward democracy emerging from within the country itself. External military interventions are always a major problem. Moreover, what the US is doing now further damages its image globally. It was already not as strong as it once was, but these attacks on boats, these threats, the unvarnished threats of regime change, they only worsen the perception. I've also wondered whether there might end up being a laughing third party in all this, China, the country gaining ever more global influence. Naturally, one could imagine that Latin American countries might lean toward China if the Americans cannot be trusted. If the US, over minor pretexts, and perhaps for self-interested reasons like access to Venezuela's oil reserves, starts conflicts, then countries may prefer to turn to China. Oil is a key issue here. Venezuela holds the largest oil reserves in the world, around 300 billion barrels. If this is explored and produced, it could also be a reason why Washington might push for regime change, to gain greater access to those reserves. Dr. Zilla noted that this is certainly possible. It may not just be economic reasons motivating the Americans, but also a desire to assert dominance over the continent as a counterweight to China. China is gaining influence, and the US may be attempting to reassert its dominance. What I also find interesting is that this seems like a return to what we saw in the 1970s and 1980s, when the US repeatedly instigated regime changes in Latin America before turning its attention to the Middle East. In my view, the transition to democracy in Venezuela must come from within, ideally integrated with regional frameworks and supported internationally, but absolutely not through threats, landing plans, or military operations. Military operations, as we've seen in many countries, rarely produce good outcomes. They bring suffering, destruction, and long-term instability. Venezuela and Latin America simply cannot afford that, and that's what the region really hopes to avoid. This episode of In Crisis Mode was produced by Alexander Baumeister, who is also a journalist at the Funke Mediengruppe. If you enjoyed this podcast, follow us, subscribe, and send your questions or feedback to Chris and Modus at funkemedien.de. Thanks for listening. Take care.
In Crisis Mode, the podcast from Conflict Zones with Jan Jessen.
Watch America's Book Club, Sunday, December 14th, with our guest best-selling author, Arthur Brooks. He joins our host, David Rubenstein. Watch America's Book Club, Sundays at 6 p.m. Eastern and Pacific on C-SPAN.